Getting the most out of in-person conferences with Ted Neuwirth.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and to run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. The podcast is sponsored by ClearMeasure, a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient, able to deliver world-class results. By the way, they are hiring both architects as well as .NET engineers who would like a path to become an architect. And so you can go to clearmeasure.com/careers for that. And if you have a comment or question for the show, you can send me an email at podcast@palermo.network. And that's P-A-L-E-R-M-O. And also my new online TV show launched about a quarter ago, 13 weeks ago. You can search for, quote, Programming with Palermo in any of the podcast directories. You can also find it on YouTube and as well as the www.palermo.network. That's always fun. Today, we have a repeat guest on the show. He was last on the show at episode 135, Ted Neuwirth. And Ted is a self-described geek who takes great pride and joy in making other geeks into bigger and better and hopefully more highly rewarded geeks. And having recently stepped into a management role, Ted has been looking for more and more ways to leverage his skills as a force multiplier across his entire team to not only better the team itself, but the entire organization as a whole. Ted, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Mr. Palermo. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I tell you what, you know, talking about making other geeks into bigger and better. You know, my midsection was certainly bigger around after the last time I was over at your house eating all that delicious food that your wife kind of prepared.
So. Yeah, it's interesting when the summits kind of went away because of pandemic and whatnot. The reaction around the house was actually a little mixed, right? On the one hand, it's like, you know, yeah, doing that MVP party every year was definitely a, you know, a heck of a lot of work, particularly for Charlotte and her friends, collectively known as Charlotte's Wives now, because they didn't like the term Ted's Wives. So they all decided they were Charlotte's Wives instead. But, you know, so she was kind of like, okay, well, you know, I'm a little sad, but I'm a little relieved. But my youngest son, Matthew, who is now 22, 23, I forget, He's actually become very much the chef of the house. Ah. And so he's actually been asking if Microsoft is going to bring the summits back, because I think he was looking forward to, you know, trotting out a few of his recipes and whatnot. So, you know, I don't think he quite understands how much work he's signing himself up for, but if the summits go back in person, there is the distinct possibility that Shay Neuwirth will become a thing again. We kind of thought we were done, but, you know, maybe not. We'll see.
Well, with Microsoft having its first in-person Ignite conference this fall, I mean, yeah, I think it's coming back. I mean, that trajectory, because Ignite, that's a massive conference. Ignite.
Yeah. I think Microsoft, like a lot of companies, you know, now that they've gotten to the point where I think they've figured out some of the broad reach, the AV, you know, because there's a lot of conferences that I've done in the last, you know, 8 to 12 months That have been in person, but have also tried to extend their reach out online, right? Yeah. I did DevOps Poland back in May, and I think the organizer said he had 2,000 people in the venue, which is basically about what the venue can hold comfortably. Mm-hmm. But then he also had another 600 or 800 people online, which was new. That was never a thing that they did before.
Yeah.
So I suspect that, you know, Microsoft is probably going to look for ways to do Summit in person, because there's just too many people that I've talked to, you know, I mean, the people that you and I hang out with at conferences, speakers, and you know, the senior folks who want to become MVPs and all that stuff. Everybody wants to get back here. Everybody wants to get back to Redmond and, you know, meet and hang out. I mean, you know, this is your tribe, right? This is people that understand you and understand, you know, what you're going through and all that stuff. And that kind of in-person experience is just really valuable. But at the same time, you know, once you've established that infrastructure for being able to do stuff remotely, why would you tear it down? Why mm-hmm. would you make it go away? And there are a lot of people that I've talked to who have said, yeah, I've always wanted to do Summit, but I've always been concerned about because I have anxiety or I have, you know, health concerns, or it's just, you know, accessibility issues, or, you know. And so I think there are a lot of valuable lessons we took out of the pandemic that will continue to roll forward, even if we all end up going back to, you know, mm-hmm. coming back to my hometown and hanging out for a week.
Right. So, well, I find it fascinating, the technology that they rolled into. I'm not sure if it's PowerPoint or something else that just automatically transcribes to captions what mm-hmm. the words that are being said by the presenter, and it gets it pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I remember back even 20 years ago, there were tools like Dragon Naturally Speaking that were dictation tools, right? So we've had, and that technology has only gotten better over the years to do that natural speech to text kind of thing. But the fact that it's now ubiquitous enough that it's making its way into all of these various tools, that now it's becoming easier to capture that on the fly. And like you said, get it right. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, there are still occasionally some closed caption shows that I watch, especially at sports, where you can tell it's a human trying to do it. And I hate to say it, but the human is frequently vastly more wrong than some of this automated stuff.
Yeah.
You know, especially considering the automated stuff can, if they're smart, they pre-program some of the names into the software. And because that's usually where the human just is like, I'm just going to do it phonetically and mm-hmm. keep rolling because I have no idea who this, you know, Giannis Tito Moko, you know, whatever, you know, it just turns into gobbledygook. And then they just
the linebacker from Hawaii.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Oh, I think the closed caption person just kind of gave up. You know, I watched one game with Teo in it, and it was just like, you just after the first attempt at the name, you know, the caption person was just like, whatever, I'm just going to say Teo and move on.
Right.
So
nice.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of conferences, you're right. It's been almost 3 years since technology conferences in person. It's kind of been on hiatus. I mean, Norwegian Developers Conference, there's been regional ones that have come back that are, you know, somewhere a few hundred or maybe less than 1,000. But you know, the big Microsoft conferences that are, in 2019, was it 15,000 at Ignite? I think is the number I remember, something like that. So in that time, we've had 3 graduating classes from universities, programmers entering the workforce, and now they're, maybe 24, 25 years old. And there's not been this conference culture or just that's not been a thing for them in their career so far. They're pretty good programmers now, you know, 3 years in, and they're rocking and rolling. In your opinion, kind of just on that front, why should programmers care about in-person conferences?
Well, it goes back to what I said earlier, right? It's concept of tribe, right? As a young developer, right, especially if you go to university for, you know, your degree, your CS degree, or if you go to University of Washington, where I teach part-time, you have the iSchool degree, which is, you know, kind of like CS, but take out the algorithms and add more entrepreneurship and whatnot. You're surrounded by people who are also in the same space, right? You're surrounded by people who are thinking the same way, who are pursuing the same goals, who have many of the same kinds of concerns and interests and so forth. And then you get out into, you know, quote unquote, the real world, right? You get that first professional job and you start writing code. And maybe you're one of those that landed at a Microsoft or a Google. And so you continue to be surrounded by people who are, you know, and large numbers of people who are in the same space. But a lot of these folks end up working for smaller companies, medium-sized businesses where the IT department is maybe six people, mm-hmm. right? Maybe 12 people, maybe 18 people, right? But at the end of the day, it's a very, very small percentage of the company.
Yeah.
Because the company doesn't sell technology. What they do is they sell something else, and IT is there to enable other things. Mm-hmm. And you look around and you start talking to people, and you know, you're not going to be friends with everybody. You know, there's going to be differences of opinion, differences of interests, et cetera. And all of a sudden, you really kind of start to feel alone. You really start to feel like you're the only one, you know, in your particular scenario, just because the law of numbers, you're just not going to make as many friends. And it can be very, very isolating, especially considering the last 3 years, right? We'd all been kind of working from home. And you'll run across handles of people online somewhere, you know, Stack Overflow, you've posted a question and somebody posts an answer. But with, you know, with all due respect to the people who work at social media companies, that's not really connection. That's yeah. not really the kind of emotional connection that human beings crave. We are social creatures. Mm-hmm. And conferences answer that, right? Yes, you can go up to YouTube, right? You can go watch videos. You can go to Pluralsight. You can go to LinkedIn Learning. There's all this content out there for you to consume as a passive observer. A buddy of mine, Billy Hollis, who you know, mm-hmm. Billy Hollis once commented that rookies go to conferences for the content. Veterans go for the people and the parties. It's about the tribe. It's about, you know, what people refer to as the hallway track. Mm-hmm. It's about meeting people who are in the same situation as you, who are struggling with the same kinds of problems as you. It's about what Don Box called it. It's about finding your tribe. It's about finding those people, you know, and that operates regardless of your level of expertise, right? You can be a, you know, wet behind the ears programmer who just, you know, just started their first job a couple months ago. You can be a sizzled veteran who's been there for, you know, 20 years. And particularly if you're that veteran, you're the one that everybody's always coming to with questions. It can be a bit awkward to have questions that you want to ask of other people. Go to a conference, meet some other grizzled veterans, and now you've started to build a tribe of folks that you can send questions to. I mean, it's the same thing, right, around user groups, right? The popularity of user groups is because we want to find that tribe. We want to find that group of people where we feel like we fit in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting. You can go and sit in a massive audience at the really, you know, big mega conferences, but there's always seems to be a question and answer area, or each technology team has a booth and you can go and ask people. And I've had some of the best conversations when I just happen to be kind of there hanging out and I hear somebody else's question. And then that starts a conversation, and those just kind of sprout into something larger.
Well, I mean, talking to that particular point, you're familiar, of course, with the phrase that I quipped a long time ago about, you know, object relational mapping is the Vietnam of computer science, mm-hmm. right?
The quagmire that never ends and everybody's still working on.
Yeah. That whole thing came out of one of those ad hoc conversations at TechEd San Diego back in 2005, 2003, way, way back in the day. Clemens Vasters and Harry Pearson and I kind of ran into each other outside at one of the after parties. And we started talking, and as was typical, we started talking shop. And we started talking about, you know, Java at that time was pursuing the object relational mapping in the form of what they called EJB entity beans. And Microsoft was routinely being pummeled in the Java press for the lack of any sort of similar support. Because mm-hmm. those who are new to the space won't remember, but, you know, entity framework does not come along for many, many years in the .NET space. It took a while for Microsoft to finally say, yeah, we should provide something along these lines.
2007 they were talking about it in the SQL Server team.
Yeah, it took a long time. It really did. And frankly, I'm still to this day not sure it was a great idea, but that can be a different debate for a different day. The fact is, you know, we were having that conversation and, you know, as was pretty typical, you know, in some cases we were, you know, Harry and Clemens and I, none of us are particularly bashful flowers, right? We generally like our opinions and we stick to them. And I forget who was taking which sides where. We probably changed sides at several points, each of us, just to keep the conversation going. But I remember at one point, you know, when I tossed off that phrase that, you know, ORM is the Vietnam of computer science, all of a sudden there was a huge burst of laughter. And I realized that there were people surrounding us like listening. It was a schoolyard fight, right? And they were stacked like three or four deep listening to the three of us have this conversation. You don't get that experience in a virtual kind of environment. You just don't. Right. It's just not the same thing. And several people pinged me later and said, you know, hey, you should like write this up, which is then I blogged it. And that's the only thing that Wikipedia knows me for now is that's captured somewhere in Wikipedia and it links to the blog and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, that kind of ad hoc conversation with peers is just, I mean, it's super, super valuable. And in some cases, it's more valuable than the event itself. You know, going back to what we were talking about earlier about the MVP Summit, I know people, you know, seasoned MVPs who will come to Summit. They will spend the money on the airfare. They will spend the money on the hotel and the rental and the you know, the dinners and all that stuff. Won't go to a single session on campus because what they want to do is reconnect with everybody in the industry.
Right.
Particularly because if you're interested in becoming more senior, if you're interested in becoming somebody like us, somebody that wants to go and speak at events, this is where these people hang out. This is where the not just the speakers, but also many of the event organizers hang out is at Summit. And you don't meet them online, you know, listening to a session. You're certainly not going to find them on YouTube. You're going to find them at the Lucky Strike during the bowling event that somebody or other is going to sponsor. You're going to find them at Patty Coins, or you're assuming the Canadians haven't taken it over again. You're going to find them at, you know, that's where that connection really happens.
Yeah, that's interesting. Microsoft has a set of marketing messages that it needs to push out. It's investing a lot of money in the conference. And it's got to get out the messages, you know, new round of tech, make sure that the whole industry knows about what they're doing the next year. And they've got to do that. But we're able to ride their coattails because it's a force that kind of pulls a lot of people into one place. And then the hallway conference can happen.
Yeah.
I remember from, I think it was 2007 to probably for, you know, 10 years later and still going to some parts. The alt.net conference, alt.net conf in Austin was one of many unconferences where it's like, oh, we're going to have a conference. What are we going to talk about? It doesn't matter. And no, we're not going to decide ahead of time. The only thing we're deciding ahead of time is, hey, let's go to this place and whatever happens will be great.
Yep. Yep. I remember when alt.net came to Seattle, right?
Yep.
And, you know, it was an interesting experience. It was one of the first unconferences I'd ever been to. But the other interesting thing that was completely serendipitous is it was being held the same weekend that a No Fluff Just Stuff show was being held in Seattle, right? And being in both the .NET and the Java communities simultaneously, I was speaking at No Fluff, and all this is in my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Summit was just the week prior. So it was this really interesting, perfect storm of people who were in town. And so we did the Summit party, and then we decided to throw a second party like a day or two later here at the house. And this time we just ordered in like a bazillion pizzas. Hanselman came by, and it was fascinating because a bunch of the Java speakers from No Fluff were, you know, were in town. So they're like, oh yeah, we'll come over. And I swear to you, Jeff, I'm standing in my living room and I'm looking and all the Java speakers are lined up along this wall and all the .NET folks are lined up along that wall. And it was like a sixth grade dance. And I really was thinking I was going to have to like walk around and like reseat them, you know, instead of boy, girl, it'd be .NET Java, .NET Java, .NET Java.
Mm-hmm.
But after about an hour, everybody was mingling, everybody was talking. And there are a lot of you know, friendships between people who are Java speakers and .NET speakers that have lasted to this day because it was really one of the first opportunities where those events got cross-pollinated.
Mm-hmm.
And again, purely serendipitous, right? This is not the kind of thing that anybody planned or that anybody intended. But you know, hey, this is, let's have an opportunity. I mean, the act of breaking bread together, even if it's something as informal as sharing a pizza, it really does a tremendous amount to bring people together and to loosen tongues and you know, lighten up opinions to the point where we can learn from each other. It's just, it's huge. It's huge.
I would say, and I want to get your take on it, for the young developers who might be going to their first sizable in-person conference like that, the times where I've stayed up late, and then, of course, I'm so tired that I miss the first few sessions the next day and just sleep in, have been perfectly fine and appropriate, because just checking on the curated scheduled sessions, everything's recorded now. You can always go back and listen to, oh, let me see that demo. That's flexible from a timing perspective, but it's almost like prioritizing maybe the lunch hour and definitely the evenings and late into the night. That's you get the more free flow conversations.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery. Clear Measure is also happy to be a sponsor of the video podcast, Programming with Palermo. Watch, learn, and program alongside Chief Architect Jeffrey Palermo. Videos are added weekly and available on syndicated locations supporting video podcast or by visiting palermo.network. Tune in today.
The parties and the people, right? Billy called it right. I really think that, especially like you said, now all the material being recorded and streamed and so forth. Mm-hmm. If you're a conference attendee, many cases, you know, some of the smaller shows, not Microsoft or Google or Amazon, but like some of the smaller commercial shows, they may put some of that content behind a paywall, but you've already paid, right? You can get that material later. The one caveat to that is frequently junior developers are sent to a conference with homework, right? You know, you have to come back and talk to us about what sessions you saw. And that can be a bit overwhelming to come back and then have to watch all those sessions online to justify, because there are a lot of managers who don't understand the value of the hallway track and the value of building that tribe and whatnot. So, you know, as always, you got to put that into the equation as part of your calculus when deciding what to do. The other thing is, you know, and this is a trend that I've noticed amongst conferences, which I'm not particularly great with, I'm not particularly comfortable with, which is a lot of conferences are kind of trying to combine professional development and family vacation, right? There's a lot of these conferences that are really stressing the idea of, oh yeah, you know, bring the family, bring the kids, you know, let the kids go. You know, the ones that are being held at water parks and other, you know, traditional recreational vacation type venues. I get what they're trying to do, right? I get that instead of trying to justify to your spouse that you need to be gone for a week, leaving them the single parent, you know, because that can be a heavy lift in many households, you know, bring them with you, right? Let's make a vacation out of the whole thing, especially because big conference season is summertime, right? And hey, if the kids are at home doing nothing anyway, combine the family vacation with the professional development. Or the other side of it is conferences in like Vegas, right? Where if you do a conference in Vegas and it's like, oh yeah, I'm in Vegas and I'm going to party it up like mad. You know, it's exactly it, right? It's a massive distraction.
Wouldn't maybe 100 miles outside of Roswell, New Mexico, be a great place for a conference? No distractions, nothing else to do except stay and maximize the hallway track.
You know, that's depending upon where Burning Man is being held this year, that may or may not be true. But I mean, I've seen people try to do conferences on cruise ships, right? We're out in the middle of the freaking ocean, right? What else is there to do?
Oh, that's what cruise ships are designed for, to occupy you with entertainment.
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, do you really want to be, I mean, as a speaker, you really want to be the person delivering the talk on, you know, how to do authentication in ASP.NET to the guy who just stumbled off of the shore excursion where he had 3 Mai Tais and 2 tequila poppers and who knows what else.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, even shows, I mean, I don't particularly care for Vegas as a destination because you do run into that.
Yeah.
Right.
Lots of distractions.
And so the young developer going to their first conference, I mean, the key thing is, yes, you should absolutely be looking at the people in the parties, be looking at making those connections, building those connections. But as with all things, it's a balance, right? Remember, this is a professional event and you represent your company, and behave, right? Mm-hmm. Behave. Don't, this is not vacation. This is not the opportunity for you to go off and get completely tanked and then come to the conference and throw up on somebody, you know, because you're tanked. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, that is the cautionary note. I have seen people get fired for their behavior at a conference, mm-hmm. even though they weren't anywhere inside the building, because it is still considered to be an extension of your professional space.
Yeah.
So with that balance, right, go for the people. Go for the parties, but don't party too hard that you lose sight of why you're really there.
We call them parties. I tend not to be a big drinker. I've gotten sponsors and I bought a lot of alcohol, but it's for everybody. But yeah, we call it a party. We're standing around and talking.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I'm with you, man. I generally don't drink at professional events like that because, to my mind, it's playing with fire, right? Now, you know, I have some family history with alcoholism, not me personally, nobody mm-hmm. in my immediate family, but the genetics are there. Yeah. And I've seen, you know, the dangers of it and so forth. So I have a little bit more cautionary nature with respect to alcohol and other forms of recreational mm-hmm. drugs, because that's becoming more of a thing. You know, I don't begrudge anybody who, you know, wants to go and have a beer as part of, you know, chatting and whatnot. My problem is, for a while in the tech space, it was definitely it was binge drinking. It was drinking to excess. It was, you know, the typical kinds of things that you see at like frat parties. And I've said it before, I'll say it again, right? If anybody's not comfortable drinking and I'm at the conference, come find me, because I'm going to be having a Diet Coke. I'm generally not a drinker at an event. And frankly, that's perfectly okay. And most events that I've been to, I've never seen anybody pressured to drink alcohol when they didn't want to. But I do know that that does happen. You know, there are some JavaScript events that developed a really bad reputation for, if you're not there and you're not drunk, something's wrong with you.
Well, you can't debate ORMs if you're not in your right mind.
or maybe you sound more coherent. I don't know. So
awesome. Well, before the show, you mentioned that you were working a little bit with some transpilers and compilers and you know, for the younger developer. I thought that was fascinating. Tell us just a quick brief about what you're playing with these days.
So way, way back during my days at UC Davis, go Aggies, you know, I crashed a couple of CS courses. I was an international relations major, but I crashed a couple of CS courses because I was interested in programming. Mm-hmm. And one of the classes I crashed was a compilers class. And there, you know, the homework assignment was take this language specification and create a transpiler. That is something that takes source and turns it into other source. So kind of like what TypeScript does, right? TypeScript takes your TypeScript source and turns it into JavaScript. Mm-hmm. source, which then gets run by any JavaScript interpreter. And so it was a transpiler that went from this custom language that the instructor called E into C code, which could then be compiled by any C compiler. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And I've been fascinated by programming languages ever since. And 20 some odd years later, it's kind of like, you know, I've been fascinated by this, but I've never really sat down and built a language from scratch, you know, like go through all the steps. I've done bits and pieces of it, but I've never actually gone, you know, the last mile. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that I was going to create my first language implementation is a already existing language called LOL code.
Laughing out loud code.
Laughing Out Loud Code. Yep, it is a programming language. It's generally considered to be an esoteric programming language, but it's a language that's essentially a straight-up procedural language that is inspired by the internet and LeetSpeak and whatnot, right? To open a LOL code program, you always begin with OHAI, O-H-A-I, and you always end a LOL code program with K-thanks-bye, right? And the rest of the keywords are similarly phrased. Like I said, it's a straight up procedural language. So you get to think about, you know, variables being declared and, you know, functions being called, loops and conditionals and mathematics and all that good stuff. And it's purely an academic exercise. You know, I'm not interested in getting 100% compatibility with the LOL code specification because, yes, there is a specification, lolcode.org. It's out there, but specifically, you know, step one, build an interpreter, something that will just take the source and execute it at runtime. Step two, build a transpiler. So I'm going to actually take source and turn it into other source. And step three, eventually a full-blown compiler, right? So generate, you know, .NET assemblies or Java jar files out the back end. Because what I want to do after I've kind of got some of these skills under my belt, you know, it's like, okay, now I know what I'm doing with respect to parser generators and ASTs and so forth, is start thinking about, you know, other languages, right? Because I really do believe that we are on the cusp of some kind of new oriented programming, right? I've been experimenting with a programming language called Ballerina from the WSO2 folks, which is a service-oriented programming language. And so the, you know, basically the foundational premise I've got right now is right now to build a typical Hello World style application that's going to go into production takes way too long, right? If you think about the stuff that we build, if you build this as a microservice, there are at least half a dozen different file formats you have to wrestle with. You know, you've got to write whatever it is in your chosen language. You've got whatever configuration. There's a Docker file. There's, you know, if there's any sort of data storage there, you've got your schema. You've got all these different things that you're juggling just to get a Hello World out, right? And the last time we've had to juggle that much complexity just to do the simplest of things, you know, and every time we've really run into that, something has come along to sort of lift the abstraction level up a level. You know, back when we were trying to do Windows programming using C files and, you know, C++ came along and took it from four files and 12 pages of code down to one file, four lines of code, right? MFC and Borland's OWL and a couple others. When memory management got to be too difficult, virtual machines, you know, sort of surged to the forefront. And, you know, garbage collection, it allowed us to focus more on the task at hand. And functional programming has come along in many respects to help us, you know, deal with those things that traditional object-oriented programming didn't. We're on the cusp for another one of these. And part of it is it's really just super complicated to build a, you know, straight up simple web application with APIs, with a rich front end, you know, all of that stuff. And so, you know, part of it is I want to take a stab at writing a language to solve some of those problems. I'm probably not going to get very far before I run into just insurmountable amounts of work. But in some cases, you know, just coming up with an idea that other people can kind of latch onto and say, oh, yeah, no, I like where this is going. And you either build a community or one of the big companies says, that's interesting. We're going to hire you to work on that. Or everybody says, oh, and here's all the terrible things that's wrong with that. And that gets abandoned, but that influences the next generation of, you know, I don't fancy myself the next Anders or the next Guido von Rossum, but plenty of interesting ideas have been floated around in the space that, you know, and there's all kinds of interesting things you learn by building a programming language, right? There's just all kinds of interesting tricks and tools and tactics and so forth. And maybe it's a reflection of my own mindset, but you frequently begin to discover that so many of the problems that we wrestle with on a day-to-day, you know, business type application are basically compiler problems. So if you can leverage some of those tools, yeah, you know, you're actually building pieces of a compiler. You don't even know it.
Yeah. When you're talking about that, it got me thinking of all of the low code solutions. Zoho is just a platform that has all that, the power platform at Microsoft. And I mean, in effect, Excel formulas and Excel equations and all that have been able to do just amazing things. Once you get into it, you get entire Excel programs and, you know, the Microsoft Office database that's still there, access. You can do tremendous things with that still to this day, but they're pushing on Power Platform and anybody can be a developer. And it's like, okay, yes, but what is the syntax? How do you manage the logic? How do you refactor to different objects? And then what is your development environment? What is your source control? What is your testing? What does it mean to pump out release candidate number 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, around all that, all those issues? Like, okay, they haven't been figured out, but they're going to have to be figured out.
And it's, you raise an interesting point, Jeff, which is, remember back when you and me were very, very small children, right? And we were first getting into programming, right? First getting into this idea of tinkering with this thing that you know, you could write code and you could see results on the screen. What I will call the hobbyist programmers of the world, right? And you start asking yourself, you know, what are the hobbyist programmers using? How are they producing an application? A buddy of mine's 12-year-old son has decided that he wants to build an application to help his schoolmates track their homework, right? Now, he's not a professional and he's not going to try to make money off of this, at least not right away. You know, there's always room for the idea that it totally takes off and next thing you know, he's making $3 million a year from all these students, blah, blah, blah. But that's generally not how these stories start, right? I just wanted to build something that's helpful. I wanted to build an application so that, you know, my church could track its softball league or whatever, right? All these hobbyists out there. And, you know, for a long time, if they wanted to build a web application, what do they use, right? Well, it's, here's ASP.NET, which means you need to learn C#. And oh, if you want to actually store data, you're going to be using either a flavor of NoSQL or you're going to be using SQL Server, and you got to host this up in the cloud, and you got to think about the gap
or between WordPress or Wix.
Well, and yeah, I mean, Wix will let you build a website.
Yeah.
But then when you want to build all of the guts behind it,
you hit a brick
wall. Right? This is really the space that I think a lot of the low-code systems, or I should say no-code systems, are really trying to go after, is that hobbyist space. The problem with a lot of those no-code solutions is the fact that, let's assume this idea takes off. Let's assume that this idea actually wants to go somewhere. And, you know, take this for a moment into a large corporation, right? Let's assume you're at Ford, or let's assume you're at Patagonia, or some of these other places that are large enough that they have people, they have software, they have established IT departments. Somebody in your company has an interesting idea, right? Oh, it'd be great if we had a website that, .. Companies are constantly talking about getting their employees to innovate. But when you start talking about innovation in IT, you start talking about having to create a full-blown specification in order to propose it to the IT department in order. And innovation requires experimentation. It requires the ability of a company to say, let's try a thing and see what happens. And yeah, okay, it may be, you know, I can try a new process for how we deal with a particular order, you know, in a value stream or something like that. But how do I try new software if the hobbyist developer inside the company can't do something like that?
Right.
They go and grab a no-code tool, but now that no-code tool has to somehow integrate within the rest of, you know, the company's fabric.
Yep.
And many of these companies have sensitive data that really needs to be tracked, right? Because this is the thing about programming languages as opposed to these low and no-code tools. If you, the vendor, host it, I don't have control over that data anymore and I can't impose my level of security controls on it, right? Whereas if you build an application using a programming language, I mean, technically that can run anywhere. even if this language actually, the artifact it creates is a Docker container, Docker can be hosted anywhere, on-prem or up in the cloud. You know, you still have some level of control.
Yep.
And I think this is part of the reason why we're starting to see a shift, right? The DevOps world is starting to say, yeah, okay, DevOps is good, but part of what we really are talking about here is platform engineering. Companies really, really want to build platforms that they can own. And that platform may in turn incorporate, you know, lots of cloud as a part of it, but they need to retain control. They need to retain elements of it.
Yeah.
And so part of what I think we, you know, are looking at, and part of what reinforces this is the emergence of all these low-code and no-code tools. That happens right before we see one of these paradigm shifts, right? We saw that with the code generators before object-oriented programming made those code generators less necessary.
The case
tools. We saw that. What's that?
The case tools that were going to generate full applications in the 90s.
Yep, exactly. We see these tools emerge right before the paradigm starts to shift because we know we want to do something, but it takes too long to write it by hand. So we build tools that will try to generate that code for us. And then inevitably somebody comes along and says, why the hell should you do? Because tools are generally one way, right? I generate something and then it, you know.
So just this past weekend, we were talking, Tuesday, something happened and we pulled up I think it was Ecclesiastes 1:5. Ancient King Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. What has been will be again. And what is to come has been here before. And like the case tools, and then early 2000s, was it around 2003, 4? I think the whole industry had this conversation around client-supported systems or these massive Excel workbooks that were essentially computer programs. And massive number of access databases, which were computer program, that whatever IT looked like, they had no knowledge of these silos. And there, I mean, at conferences, I remember the big conversation being, how do you discover these data silos? How do you bring them into the fold? How do you properly manage them? How do you audit them and make sure that you, oh, there's social security numbers in that Excel workbook. That's how many megabytes large is that now? And so now with the low code, we're doing it again where we're encouraging people to create new data silos. Who cares that it's hosted in a cloud provider? It's that somebody created it. Somebody knows about it, but most people don't know about it.
Right. That's the thing is there's always a tension between, you know, trying to centralize everything and trying to decentralize everything. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's just going to be a classic tension that goes on indefinitely. Inside of computer science, inside of, you know, IT, right? You know, the business as well as the computer science part of IT. And, you know, going back to access for a second, right? You know, access was one of those platforms that enabled people to create solutions very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've been asking various folks at Microsoft as well as other places is, you know, what is the Microsoft access of the web? Right. If I wanted to build a database front end, by definition, a monolith, right? But if I wanted to build something like that, what is the tool that we would use that would be web enabled?
Yeah.
And nobody has a consistent, coherent answer unless it's, I don't think there is one, right? And that's what these no code tools are desperately trying to become, is they're trying to be the Microsoft Access. But in doing so, they've got a commercial stake in it somehow. And so they want to, you know, loop you in. They want to sort of bring you into their fold. And now your stuff lives there. And, you know, your typical IT department is going to have major, major concerns with that, especially because of all the GDPR and financial concerns, HIPAA, and all that good stuff. It's like, okay, wait, hang on. You know, I can't just let you go to a Power BI and build your own solution. Because even if you know, raise your right hand and solemnly swear that you're not going to store any sensitive data, there's a lot of data that you, the hobbyist developer, won't realize is sensitive that you're capturing, you're not pushing all the way through. And in many cases, even if you're just holding it temporarily, right? Oh, I'll just write it to this file and then I'll delete it when I'm done, kind of thing. You know, IT governance is going to have major, major issues with this.
How many people sign up contractors? You got to get a W-9. Oh, what's on the W-9? A social security number. So literally a filled in PDF or even a scan of the PDF on a network drive, it's the same issue.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so this is where, you know, because of all the complexity required to build a traditional IT application, right? Web app, API, possibly a mobile front end, what have you. People are going to be turning to some of these tools. And until we figure out how to solve for some of the complexity, right? And the best way to solve it in many respects is to, you know, level up the paradigm, level up the you know, the level at which you and I work as application developers so that so much of the rest of this stuff kind of becomes commodity. And you know, what's really funny is I've started investigating, there are some programming languages that have been out in the past, including one very, very rarely known language called MUMPS or M. Not the M that Microsoft tried to do about 10 years ago as part of Oslo and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But MUMPS was a language that emerged out of the 80s, I think. I forget what it stands for. Something to do with Massachusetts. But it's a programming language. It's basically a procedural programming language that had as one of its data types what they called globals, which was basically data storage. Like if you put something into a global variable, it would write that to disk. It was basically storing to the database. And take that for a moment and pause, right? Imagine if we could declare, you know, if we could declare entities, let's not call them objects, let's call them entities. And the persistence logic is already baked in. And every time you access some value in this entity, intrinsically there is transactional scope that's involved. And, you know, when you store to this, it's stored under, I mean, just imagine now we start mingling some of the data storage logic that we typically have to either write or defer to something like Entity Framework, but combine that as part of programming. And, you know, then imagine that we actually have a tool that makes it easier for us to build user interfaces as opposed to XAML and a whole bunch of code behind. You know, this is part of leveling up the abstraction level. This is part of making it easier so that, you know, if you want to sit down and build a non-trivial application, you can do it in days instead of weeks, weeks instead of months, you know, especially if it's built on top of existing standards like APIs, right? Because that, you know, that wouldn't be all that tricky to do. Or at least that's my working presumption, which is part of the reason why I'm diving into figuring out how to build programming languages, because I want to figure out how to do this stuff. And if it inspires somebody, great. And if somebody wants to hire me, great. And if a community wants to build up around it, great. I don't know. I'm just, this is fun stuff for me. So I'm going to have some fun.
Good deal. Good deal. Well, this was a fun conversation for me. Always is talking with you, Ted. So, I know the listeners invariably enjoyed it as well. So thanks so much for coming back on the Azure DevOps podcast.
Oh, yeah. Anytime, man. Anytime. I enjoy these.
Awesome. Thanks so much. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.